Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance here on WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, we'll be talking about the depiction of the classroom in pop culture and how the portrayal of scholastic life has evolved throughout the years. Returning as my guest is Tim Sherry, Director of Film Video Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of youth culture in film. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me back, Kevin.
So, Tim, in your book, you talk about how each high school generation lasts only 3 to 4 years, and thus everything from manners of speech to styles and societal attitudes can shift dramatically in a short period of time. And your book, Generation Multiplex, was published a few years after the Columbine Massacre in 99, when studios were obviously very reluctant to show violence in any sort of school setting. And it's been 10 years since Columbine and 7 years since the publication of your book. And I know you've done another book called Youth Culture and Global Cinema. That's more recent. But how would you characterize the cinematic depiction of the classroom in 2009?
Well, I think lately the industry, the film industry, is much more curious about young people in terms of their odd habits, their foibles and debacles. I don't think the film industry, as it was in the early 90s, cares that much about young people's struggles, their confrontations with violence, their arguments over the quality of their lives. I think there's this assumption, even though we're in obviously a great economic crisis across the country and across the world, but I think there's this assumption that young people are somehow weathering the storm and enjoying themselves. And you see relatively few films about young people truly struggling with social issues, and those that are made don't become very popular.
Has there been a decline in the number of movies featuring the classroom?
In terms of classroom movies or movies about school, I would say there hasn't been a dramatic decline, but what we have seen are fewer movies about the negative influence or the negative conditions of schools. There were films, I would say, into the late 90s and early 2000s regarding schools that were underfunded, overpopulated, riddled with violence. The last major one I can think of was called Light It Up, and that was around 2001. We have far more depictions of schools being, you know, maybe places of contention for social hierarchy, like Mean Girls or Napoleon Dynamite. But those aren't films in which, for instance, there's great tension between the different castes of school power. And I think the industry generally has been avoiding that. And I also think, curiously enough, that the industry has been, for the most part, avoiding films about influential teachers. The inspiring teacher film was something of a staple from the 50s into the 60s, the teacher that shows up to make a difference, and doggone it, he or she is going to help educate these kids. And we saw that even lingering into the 80s with films like Lean on Me. And yet the only films that I've seen in the past few years that feature that kind of character have been more so about coaches, have been about athletic directors or, you know, coaches of certain sports teams like Coach Carter or We Are Marshall, or Remember the Titans with Denzel Washington, where the inspiration comes from winning for the team and not learning for the sake of success. And I find that very curious. I think sports remain a very vital component of the high school experience, if not also the middle school experience. I think the movies thrive, of course, on the mythology of competition and winning and overcoming adversity through determination, which is great to teach young people. I think a lot of young people need to understand and appreciate that they can overcome their environment or their difficult upbringing through determination and perseverance, yet you see so few films that show young people doing that through, say, studying or, you know, working really hard at, say, music or art. And you see far more films that show young people achieving some kind of notoriety through athleticism.
But with the exception of a film like Friday Night Lights, you have relatively, though, few films, I think, today dealing with high school sports.
Overall, that's been true in the past decade or so. I can think of Varsity Blues from the late 90s. being one of the last films to really celebrate high school athleticism. And I was going to say, even that film at that time was suggesting, through the main character, Mox, played by James Vanderbeek of Dawson's Creek fame, he recognizes at the end that they won the state championship, but it was just a moment in time. It didn't make him a star quarterback in the NFL. It was just something that they enjoyed for that moment. And perhaps with the exception of Coach Carter in, I think that was 2004 or thereabouts, you're right. We haven't had as many films that utilize the athletic role for the heroic mythology as we had. We've definitely seen more films in general in terms of school about groups of students and senses of popularity than athleticism per se. And certainly, what is one of the primary reasons young people don't want to see movies about young people in class or reading or studying? It's because they have to do that most of their day. Young people don't want to go to see movies about other young people doing the things that they bemoan. They want to see movies about young people winning athletic contests or overcoming the clique system of their school or having a good time at parties. No young person wants to go see a film in which other young students are studying really hard and winning academic prizes. They want to see more entertaining and taboo subject matter than being successful in school.
Well, even with adults, right? You wouldn't want to go see a film about someone going to the office every day, right, and filling out forms.
Unless the office was really exciting or quirky. You know, the success of a few recent television shows in that regard, especially The Office, the show called The Office, is exactly a demonstration of that, because people, again, they don't want to see their daily lives reportrayed to them. They want to see movies and TV shows about doctors, lawyers, detectives, superheroes, people who can predict the future. Even the so-called reality shows, as they are called, put people into situations that are quite extraordinary, or they're about people who themselves are extraordinary. And it's the same logic that goes with teenagers. They want to see films that are about things truly out of their ordinary experience. Otherwise, they wouldn't pay to go.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Tim Sherry, who's the director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of youth culture in film. And we're talking about the depiction of the classroom in film throughout the years. And just talking a little bit about the decline in the number of sports-related high school films that we've seen recently. And on that subject, I wanted to go back to the chapter that you wrote in Generation Multiplex about the student archetypes that you see very easily defined in a classic film like The Breakfast Club, which came out in the mid-80s, a John Hughes film, where you have the jock and you have the rebel and the nerd and the rich girl. And I'm forgetting the loner, I think, right? The Ally Sheedy character.
Well, I call her the rebel.
Oh, she's the rebel. Okay. So the delinquent, I think, is also
delinquent.
Yes.
Absolutely. By far the most common character in teen films since the 50s until the end of the 90s was the delinquent. The delinquent is dramatic. The delinquent obviously runs into conflict and either reforms or dies, and that makes for great drama. Yet we've certainly seen a distinct decline in delinquency depicted on screen since Columbine, and we've seen a distinct increase in the vilification of the popular. Since really right around 99, we've seen many movies such as Cruel Intentions, and more recently Mean Girls, and even to some extent on television Gossip Girl. We see a lot of depictions, especially of young women, girls in high school, being vindictive, being overly catty, duplicitous, and being brought to atone for that. And I think that's perhaps on one level a reaction to feminist empowerment over the past 20 or 30 years. I think it's also, of course, just like with Desperate Housewives for a slightly older audience, I think it's just plain old soap opera entertainment. Yet we don't see boys treated quite the same way. We see a lot more girls being criticized for their popularity or abusing their popularity. I think that's quite striking in recent years.
Well, yeah. I mean, the difference between the depiction of those girls in a film like Mean Girls versus Clueless, mm-hmm. which came out in the mid-90s with Alicia Silverstone, where she is a very rich girl, she's very popular, very beautiful, has all sorts of rich friends. She's not portrayed in that same sort of light, though. She's portrayed as an endearing character.
No, I agree. I think until perhaps the mid-90s, you were still able to portray popular girls with some level of levity, with some level of appreciating their ignorance about their privilege. And by the turn of the century, it was no longer funny or endearing that certain girls had the looks and or especially the wealth to be so ignorant and inconsiderate of those around them. And that's the whole joke of Clueless, of course, is that she doesn't realize how privileged she is. She takes up the Pismo Beach disaster relief as if that's her great cause in life, and it's just because she hears that there's some beach erosion and she's going to help the beach. She's not doing it because she really feels for the environment. She's doing it as another way of making herself look good. And by the time you get to a film like Mean Girls in 2004, there's a great suspicion around girls who use their looks and popularity to simply advance their own empowerment or their own visibility in the community, especially in school. If you look at a film like Pretty Persuasion, which I believe came out in 2005, that's a film starring Evan Rachel Wood in which she, through very nefarious means, rises to great notability. She manipulates everyone around her, and yet in the end, even though, well, I won't spoil the ending, I'll just simply say in the end she prevails on some level, yet it's quite clear that she is the worse for it. And I think that this is a trend that has not only been going on for probably at least 5 to 10 years, but it's likely to continue.
In terms of the archetype of the nerd, do you think that there's not as much social stigma involved with being the nerd today in terms of film versus 20 years ago? You certainly seem to have an increase in the number of films about nerds.
That's true. I don't think there is as much of a stigma, and this has been commented on in many other contexts, due to the fact that nerds like Bill Gates have become incredibly wealthy. He's the classic nerd who rose up through knowing computers and is now one of the world's richest people. Yet at the same time, I think in the high school system, there's always going to be pressure on the students to not appear too smart, to not appear too conformist. That's what gives nerds their value to teachers and their disdain from their peers, because the nerd excels at the very thing that school is designed to promote, which is, of course, education. And the rebels are the ones that, or the delinquents are the ones that resist it and that stand out and on some level, of course, are far more intriguing and attractive. And the nerds appear to be conformist and lacking in style. And that's not always the case. There are indeed many truly attractive, stylish, smart people out there. It's just that movies don't tend to get made about them.
Well, I am thinking of Say Anything,
yeah,
a film that came out in the late 80s with John Cusack, and I think it was Ione Skye?
Yes, and she's the valedictorian of the class who's quite pretty and stylish and lives quite well, and yet for some reason no one knows her, and that's the structuring enigma of why John Cusack pursues her, why his character Lloyd pursues her, is because no one really seems to know this super smart girl who lives with her father and has apparently no mother in the picture. And it's because she's not popular. It's because she's not one of the accepted girls in the class, even though she is so pretty, that he's able to become so endearing to her. And again, I think that this nerdly girl character is so often depicted as either being out of the popular realm or simply a little bit crazy. I think back to The Breakfast Club with the Ally Sheedy character, Allison. She's rebellious only insofar as she is smart enough to know how to manipulate the other kids. She's really quite distraught about how her parents treat her, parents who apparently have some wealth but nonetheless ignore her.
Just getting back to the subject of nerds really quickly, kind of contrast to the Ionia Sky character in Say Anything that you have a film like Welcome to the Dollhouse, which came out in the mid-90s, a Todd Solondz film, that where you have a girl in seventh grade who's kind of the opposite of her. She is not particularly intelligent, but yet just a total social outcast in terms of the way she dresses, and she's got glasses that are too big, and she's just incredibly awkward. It's an amazing film. It's very, very painful to watch. You see on a regular basis at that junior high school is just hell for this girl.
The Heather Matarazzo character there, Dawn Wiener, is also an outcast in her own family. She's a middle child. Her older brother appears to be more academically successful. Her younger sister appears to be prettier and more appreciated by her parents and the local community. And so she has this classic insecurity about her sense of status and her sense of power. And she goes out of her way to investigate how other kids in her community gain their power and their authority. And it turns out that there's this rebellious delinquent boy that she develops quite a crush on, but not as much of a crush as her brother's much older friend who plays guitar in his band. And the relationship, I think that film demonstrates quite well the sensitivities of the relationships among early teens, at least, because the relationship between her and the younger boy completely falls apart when she confesses to him that she, as she says, is in love with another man. It really is just another crush that she doesn't quite entirely understand. I think if you compare that film to another Heather Matarazzo film from about 8 years later called Saved, in which she plays a girl in a very religious school among other girls who are trying to come to terms with their sense of piety and their sense of righteousness. Saved is one of the very few but really great films about young people dealing with religion. I've said so many times that the majority of young people in America belong to a church or they consider themselves quite religious, and yet you would never know that through watching teen TV shows or movies. You would think the great majority of kids in America have no religious identification or any sense of religious values whatsoever. And yet, the great majority of them do. And in Saved, you see Heather Matarazzo, along with Mandy Moore and a few other characters, dealing with their sense of devotion, their sense of morality, and in the case of one of the characters, his sexuality. And I applaud Saved as one of the rare films that combines both this school setting in terms of contesting for popularity with religious ideals and moral values.
One of the other sub-themes of Welcome to the Dollhouse, though, is the fact that the teachers seem to dislike Dawn almost as much as the other students do.
Yes, and I think that might be a little bit overplayed for the sake of the film's sardonic comedy. And yet it's true. It's certainly true that there are teachers that have their pets. There are teachers that applaud some students over others. And speaking as a professor myself, I think every teacher longs for the great pupils that are truly going to emulate your approach. They're going to go off into the field and accomplish as much or more than you. They love what you teach. And, of course, a very, very high percentage, well over 90% of all the students that any teacher teaches are not going to be successful in the field that they have adopted and that they have dedicated themselves to. And that's even more frustrating in college, where students are meant to be focused on and devoted to a specific area, and yet certainly more than a little bit, probably more than half of all students who take on a major in college do not go into a career in that major. And of those that do, certainly a much smaller percentage become quite proficient and successful in that field. So I think that some of that in Welcome to the Dollhouse is played off, as I said, just for the sake of sardonic humor, but I think it's also meant to demonstrate how frustrating it is for both teachers and adults in general to deal with young people who aren't going to follow their examples, who aren't going to listen to them, and who are ultimately going to rebel and do what they want no matter what we tell them.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined by Tim Sherry, Director of Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of youth culture in film. And we're talking all about the portrayal of scholastic life throughout the years. And Welcome to the Dollhouse is also a little bit of an exception due to the fact that we see a depiction of junior high school. We've got lots and lots of films about high school settings. A few films about kindergartners, first graders, but very few films about that middle age group in terms of, say, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. Why do you think that's the case?
I think there's a very clear reason why that's the case, and it largely has to do with the burgeoning sexuality of young people and the potential for moral corruption or delinquency. We tend to think of children under the age of perhaps 8 as being completely innocent, unable to have clear moral convictions, and for the most part non-sexual. And obviously we think of high schoolers somewhere around the age of 13 or 14 as becoming sexual and more morally responsible and culpable for what they do. But somewhere probably between about 8 and 13, the child turning into the adult is very vulnerable and sensitive, and I think our culture doesn't quite know how to address the younger persons, meaning the, you know, the middle schoolers' questions about sexuality and morality. They're getting old enough to wonder why there are rules the way they are, why there are things that they can and can't do. They're beginning to experiment, not just sexually, but in some cases with drugs and alcohol. And, of course, those are very taboo issues, whereas it seems to be that when 16, 17-year-olds, at least in movies, experiment with drugs and alcohol, we can laugh about it. We think it's somewhat funny. We know it's against the law because they're underage, but it can be played off humorously. There would be very little humor in seeing, say, 11 or 12-year-old getting drunk or trying drugs. We would find that quite tragic and not at all funny. And I think the same goes for sexuality. I think that's one of the reasons that makes Welcome to the Dollhouse quite a powerful film, because Dawn, who's 11 or 12 in the film, is beginning to discover her sexuality, and of course she's quite confused about it. I think most young people really start to question their, not their sexual identity perhaps so much, but their sexual practice, whether they should masturbate, whether they should have crushes, if their crushes are legitimate or not, and if they are actually able to interact with people of the opposite or same sex, what they should do. But that's still a great taboo subject. We can laugh a lot more about that with older characters in their later teens, and we can find it very cute with 4- and 5-year-olds, but it's just a greatly delicate issue with people, I would say, between 8 and 13, and I think that makes most audiences uncomfortable, and certainly most parents uncomfortable. And yet the sad fact of the matter is that that's the age at which I think most young people need the most guidance, because I think they do need to be helped along and told that things like exploring their bodies or having crushes, falling in love, being confused about their their growing pains and so on is perfectly normal. And unfortunately, I think our culture still too often represses that or suppresses that, and young people are left in the dark. And by the time they get to high school, the taboos are still there. It's just that now the culture finds it easier to laugh at them.
Well, you mentioned the age group 8 to 13. We had a film called 13 that came out back in 2003 with Evan Rachel Wood and Holly Hunter. And we have a lot of those themes that you just talked about in terms of underage sexual behavior and drug abuse. And how do you think that that film dealt with those sorts of issues?
I think that's one of the great films about young female experience in the past decade. She confronts both her questions about sex, but also about drug use, and above all, her questions about power and popularity. She's under the influence of a friend who's clearly more sexualized and more connected to other kids at her school, and she emulates her, and she wants to fit in, and that is one of the all-time classic dilemmas for young people, of course, is acceptance. And I think that doesn't go away into adulthood. We always want to be accepted, whether it's through our work or our church or just our local neighborhood and community. We always want to be accepted and feel that we belong to some group or with some other community. And schooling is the first proving ground of that for young people after they get away from the confines of home. And in 13, the Evan Rachel Wood character navigates these different arenas of popularity, be it drug use, self-abuse. You know, she turns to cutting herself. She gets pierced. She starts wearing much more revealing and provocative sexual clothing. And I will say this for 13, which more films I wish would do, is that she has a very strong parent character, in this case Holly Hunter, who's her mother, is really there trying to help her out. And furthermore, she's not a saint herself. The mother has had her own drug problems. She's gone through rehab. She's struggling to make ends meet financially, but she's really trying to help her daughter and to pay attention to her. And of course, her daughter's resistant, as most young teenagers are. They're rebellious and they want to strike out to form some identity on their own. But the film ends quite poignantly with the mother intervening in her daughter's self-destruction and standing by her. And not, you know, she's of course concerned and she's worried, but she really stands by her. And in the end, she recommits herself to helping her daughter get through this terrible time. And I think that's, again, one of the great films of the past decade that illustrates how strong parenting, even if it's sometimes flawed or if parents have come through their own troubles, is extremely important to young people. And it also shows the influence of the potentially negative influence of other peers. As I understand it, Nikki Reed, who co-wrote the script and who plays the bad influence on Evan Rachel Wood's character, herself went through the same kind of circumstance in school, which is what motivated her to write the story. I can only imagine how many young people, male or female, are out there today dealing with similar confrontations in terms of just wanting to be accepted and just wanting to feel like they fit in.
That sort of movie is only a movie that can be made in the current time period. You can't imagine a movie like 13 being made in 1983 as opposed to 2003.
Well, I think if it would have been made in the earlier 80s, it may have tried to play off the drug use, at least, a little more lightly, which is what I still think some movies today try to do. I think it certainly would have played the sexuality more lightly. You have to remember, it wasn't until the mid-80s that the majority of the country even thought AIDS was a heterosexual threat. Of course, there was venereal disease, but there were so many teen comedies into the mid-80s that were about promiscuous sex and how goofy and funny it was. It wasn't funny after the mid-80s when it became evident that not only could AIDS be spread through promiscuous sexual contact, but the teenage pregnancy rate had been going up and up and up. I think a movie like 13 doesn't want to politicize those issues so much as it wants to just simply look at how the influence of our culture in terms of sexualizing young women, well, girls, and in terms of pushing them to grow old too fast.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Tim Sherry, who's the director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of youth culture in film, and we're talking about the depiction of the classroom in popular culture. And I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about perspectives of the faculty. And throughout the years, we've had lots of films about administrations and teachers taking over tough schools. We've had films like Lean on Me, films, you know, The Principal with Jim Belushi.
Yeah, Belushi, right.
Yeah. We've had The Substitute. I think Tom Berenger plays an ex-Green Beret.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah. We've had lots of those kinds of films. And you've also had the inspirational teacher films like the Edward James Olmos playing Jaime Escalante in Stand and Deliver. The Robin Williams character in Dead Poets Society. But you don't have many films where you're actually looking at school through the eyes of the faculty, unless they're trying to instill order in a lawless school. Even the Dead Poets Society, you're really looking at the film through the eyes of the students more. Why do you think that is?
As I said before, I think that because Hollywood and movies in general thrive on drama and on conflict, there's just simply not as much interest in showing teachers who come into a reasonably challenging situation, perhaps, and make it better. They have to come into a catastrophic situation and make it better, or come into a situation and make it catastrophic. Now, that's less often the case, but I think of a film like 187, which came out in the late 90s with Samuel L. Jackson, and it's a film in which a teacher who has been previously wounded by students takes on the incredibly ridiculous role of eliminating by killing the bad elements in his new school. It's really a preposterous film, and there's not too many like that, but more often you get films like Light It Up, where Judd Nelson, of all people, from The Breakfast Club, plays the inspiring teacher who encourages his students to rise up and fight for better school conditions, or Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer, also a former military service member like the Tom Berenger character in The Substitute. And these people come into schools that are troubled. They come into classrooms where there's disorder, and they show them the love of learning, and they inspire in them some great sense of the value of succeeding academically. I think that we haven't seen so many films like that lately, perhaps because it could just simply be that a lot of middle-aged actors don't want to take those roles. It could be that more emphasis is on young people themselves and what they deal with in terms of their teachers. When I think of recent school films like, 13 only has a little bit to do with school, but say Mean Girls, Napoleon Dynamite, they very rarely focus on the teachers. They very rarely have much to say about the actual learning environment. They're much more about the contestations for popularity, for recognition, for acceptance. And teachers are there to remind us of the learning aspect and not of the value of acceptance.
So I want to jump to one of the more unusually themed school-related films to be released in recent years. We have Brick, which is a detective story where one of the students, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, is trying to find his missing ex-girlfriend.
I can't say enough about how challenging and experimental Brick is as a teen film, because it's trying to be a film noir revision and uses a definite lingo that I don't think any kids in real life use today. So stylistically, it's quite radical, yet at the same time, it's dealing with issues that I think young kids today do confront, such as drug use, drug dealing, criminality, and confusions around the role of authority among young people themselves and with school administrators and teachers. And I found its style is certainly perhaps a little challenging or off-putting to some viewers, but it's a film that takes this noir approach to contemporary teen issues and I think makes it work quite effectively. I wouldn't consider it entirely realistic in terms of its approach, in terms of its style, but very realistic in terms of its subject matter.
You mentioned Brick being a film noir, basically set in a high school. I think it's a tremendous movie. One of the elements that just jumps out at you is when you're watching Brick, the dialogue just seems very mature for that age group. And these kids are in high school, but they're basically talking like they're 30.
Right. And that's the contrivance of the film that some people might not be able to accept, because the dialogue is very heavily written. It's very overdetermined for young people. They speak with a confidence and a lingo that no real high school would have anywhere in the U.S. today. And at the same time, their surroundings, I think, are probably quite familiar to a lot of young people in terms of there being a power system within a school, better teachers and worse teachers, administrators that are sometimes corrupt themselves. I think of a film like Pump Up the Volume, one of my very favorite films about school, and the interesting conflict there is that the main character, played by Christian Slater, has a father who turns out to be the superintendent of the school system, yet he is completely and woefully unaware of how poorly run his own son's high school is, because he's wrapped up in looking at this entire system, and he can't see the forest for the trees. And his son, over time, exposes the corruption in his own school, and his dad, at the very end, helps him to the rescue by firing his high school principal, who has been not involved in drugs or crime per se, but who's simply been manipulating the SAT scores and GPAs of her students in order to get more funding. And so it's this very politicized way of showing educational corruption. And he, Christian Slater's character, Harry, becomes something of a hero. He becomes an inspiration to the kids at the school because he goes on his pirate radio station and encourages them and actively urges them to protest the school, to protest their state in life, and to get out and, as he says, you know, steal the air and talk hard. And I wish we had more films like that that would show young people, especially through the internet nowadays, that they have incredible power and access to communication. I've said since the mid-90s that it's striking how much the industry, the film industry, has avoided the power of the internet and computers, whereas in the early to mid-80s, there were films like War Games, Defense Play, Explorers, My Science Project, Space Camp. There were numerous films about young people working with computers, working with science, becoming really powerful and sometimes deviant. And yet, it seems today in movies, the only thing we see young people doing with technology is making cell phone calls and texting each other. They're not using the internet to gain greater knowledge or to foment rebellion and to organize themselves. I think in real life, they're doing that a lot more. We just don't see that in the media nearly as much.
Oh, sure. In terms of political organization, that's been a huge part of the last few presidential campaigns.
Absolutely. And I think in terms of sites like Facebook and other sites, MySpace and so on, I think a lot of young people are actively not only communicating with each other, but forming groups, supporting each other, and helping each other through the difficulties of life. For some reason, the movies want to either ignore that or pretend as if it's all happening in this more archaic mode of simple high school conflict, when in reality, I think there is so much more communication and information going on outside the high school setting than ever before.
Well, I think it's tough to depict that sort of thing in dramatic context, to make it exciting for someone to post to a blog.
And you're right. If there's no better example of that, it's a film that I only show in excerpts to my classes, which is called Hackers from 1995. And it's this completely absurd depiction starring Angelina Jolie of teenagers who hack into computer systems and how they supposedly prevent a major environmental disaster. And yet, when you watch it, especially now, some 14 years later, it just looks completely silly. The graphics and the way the kids talk in this computer lingo, the way that they actually punch their keyboards as if they're, playing some form of racquetball or tennis. It's completely ridiculous movie, and yet obviously the director and the producers felt that they had to give it that panache and that sense of drama. And you're absolutely right. I don't know what kind of dramatic impact you could really demonstrate with kids sitting down, logging into their blogs and communicating their frustrations. It's much more interesting to see them actually in a school setting arguing with each other or fighting or playing sports even.
I mean, you mentioned a film like War Games with the Matthew Broderick film that came out in the early 80s where he taps into NORAD and almost starts World War III. And a kid looking at this today in 2009 would wonder, what the heck he's doing with this, this dial-up modem or, phone modem that he's using to connect. There's no such thing as the internet back then.
And his computer in that film takes up about half of his room.
Yeah.
my students get a big kick out of it when I show them those scenes because he's using floppy disks that are the size of old, LPs. And he sits there, and the director obviously wanted to make sure that we understood that he could communicate with a computer. So it's not just enough for him to type the words onto the screen. He actually speaks them out loud as he does it. Would you like to play a game? Or I would like to play global thermonuclear war. And it looks very primitive by today's standards. At the same time, having said that, I think young people today don't find it all that thrilling that they can talk to each other by cell phone, or they can use Twitter, or they can obviously use the internet. They take that for granted, of course, that level of communication out there. And just like they don't want to see movies about young people sitting in classrooms and learning lessons about English or history or science. They also probably don't really care to see movies about young people doing the things that in real life they take for granted every day.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Yes.
Which I got a chance to check out a few days ago. To be quite honest, I hated the film.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've read, it's very tough to predict who will like and dislike that particular film. People are very, very split on it.
Yes.
And depicting the life of a very nerdy high school kid. But, you know, you have the endearing nerds and you have the nerds that you don't think have any sort of redeeming quality whatsoever. And I think that this character, Napoleon Dynamite, falls in the latter category.
Mm-hmm. Well, until Juno, Napoleon Dynamite was the film that I had been called on the most to discuss in interviews and in the press. It was a film that generated relatively little attention when it first came out, but developed such a cult following and such an interest among young people, I think partly because it's so flat in its effect. It has a very dry sense of humor, sometimes absurd sense of humor, which makes it more endearing perhaps to young people who just think it's silly. And yet, as you say, the main character is not incredibly smart. He's not incredibly talented at anything. He's just truly a kind of bumbling, awkward teenage guy. He's, you know, too tall for his own body, so to speak. He's gangly and not very attractive. And he finds his cause in promoting his friend Pedro for class president. And I think that is another aspect of the film that makes it ring true, or at least inspire young people, which is that so often I think they're simply looking for something with which they can identify themselves, something that'll make them visible and popular. And I have heard so many young people say that his dance at the end, and if you didn't finish the film, you didn't get to see his dance, but he does this incredibly unusual dance in front of the entire school to help promote his friend Pedro running for student president. And that young people say that that was such a demonstration of his sense of confidence and style. And it's played for laughs. It's certainly played for laughs. But I can't help but think, because of its popularity, that a lot of young people identify with that character who simply wants to get through his high school years and his awkward years and get on with life, and finds a very subtle, not incredibly significant or incredibly dramatic cause, but finds a cause, and that helps sustain him through his turbulent times in high school.
Well, my issue, I mean, one of the issues that I have in Napoleon Dynamite is just that the main character is not a very likable guy.
Right.
He's just rude to everyone he meets.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that he's friends with Pedro is that basically Pedro is this foreign student who doesn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone knows enough about Napoleon Dynamite to stay far away from him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would put it to you that the great majority of teenagers aren't very likable. And in fact, the teenagers that are popular and that are very likable come under great suspicion. This is why in the past 15 years or so, we've seen so many movies about how popular kids are really villainous and venal and evil on the inside. There is this great questioning of how it is that some young people can get through life happily and not turn to any kind of drugs or alcohol or vice, and somehow manage to be successful. I think that there's a much greater interest in and sympathy for those young people that are themselves tormented, angry, perhaps have turned to vices to cope, and the great majority of us can relate to those characters much more. I think that's what made The Breakfast Club such a success, is because all five of the characters in that film eventually admit to their faults. The nerd turns out to not be so smart when it comes to developing a lamp in shop class. The popular girl turns out to really be distraught about her parents. She's got wealth and she's got looks, but her parents and her home life are terrible. Of course, the delinquent is already angry, but he just wants a platform to voice his frustration, and so on and so forth. I think those are the young people that so many other young people can relate to. And I think Napoleon Dynamite being kind of a boring, boorish, and somewhat, in some ways, even mean-spirited guy, at least at first, is a character that a lot of young people can connect with, unlike, say, the popular girls and Mean Girls, who are meant to be held out for ridicule and for criticism, compared to the Lindsay Lohan character, who overcomes that, supposedly, and at the end realizes she's still a good person. And of course, that ending rings completely hollow as a result.
Yeah. You know, I'd suggest if you put Napoleon Dynamite into the room with the Breakfast Club kids at the end of that morning or the end of that day, they'd probably beat him to a pulp, I'm suggesting. You know, that's...
Well, you know what? That's such a great point, Kevin. The whole difference there is that Napoleon Dynamite, as a character, seems so unaware of himself. He seems so shallow, and he just doesn't seem to be really introspective. And perhaps that's one of the qualities, again, that makes him somewhat endearing to young people watching that film today, is that he doesn't sit around contemplating the great mysteries of his life and, you know, why he is the way he is. He just simply is trying to get by. And I think more often in real life, young people are riddled with existential questions and the nature of their metaphysical presence in the world and so on. But Napoleon Dynamite is a great escape. It's a great goofy movie that I think young people can look at and not have to take too seriously. And that's obviously part of what made it such a success.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham. I've been joined by Tim Sherry, who's the director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of youth culture in film. And I think you have an upcoming book coming up, an anthology about masculinity in film?
Yes, in fact, I'll be sending that to the press in the next month. It's right now simply titled American Movie Masculinity. It's an anthology of 17 articles dealing with topics ranging from different acting styles to different character types. There's some authors that look at actual actors like Philip Seymour Hoffman or Clint Eastwood, and certain directors, Wes Anderson. In my case, I look at Michael Mann, certain directors that have dealt with more masculine topics in recent movies. It's primarily focused on films since the 80s, so it's meant to be a more recent examination of movies about men and male identity in Hollywood cinema.
I'd love to have you on in the future to discuss the book when it comes out.
I'd be very happy.
Well, thanks so much, Tim. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely, Kevin. Take care.